From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, the past century of laws regulating sex, marriage, homosexuality, rape, adultery, pornography, prostitution. We talk with Eric Berkowitz, author of The Boundaries of Desire. He says the law has had trouble keeping up with our changing standards. Also,
if I die in the
music critic Amanda Petrusich plays us some of the world's rarest 78 RPM records. 78s and the people who collect them are the subject of her book. These recordings only held about 3 minutes per side and were often made in one take.
There was a red light that would come on in the studio often when a performer was sort of reaching the end of his or her, 3 minutes. So on a lot of these records, you can hear someone sort of start to hurry up and panic when the light came on, that they had to finish up.
That's on Fresh Air. Before we get back to Fresh Air, here's another podcast you might enjoy, the TED Radio Hour. You'll hear discussions about fascinating ideas, amazing inventions, fresh approaches to old problems, and new ways to think and create. You can find the TED Radio Hour podcast at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app. The sex drive is one of the most fundamental human urges, and throughout history, there have been laws regulating what is considered acceptable sexual behavior. In the past century, the law has had trouble keeping up with changing social and moral standards, according to my guest, Eric Berkowitz. He's the author of the new book, The Boundaries of Desire. It's about American sex laws of the past century, laws pertaining to marriage, homosexuality, adultery, rape, sex workers, and pornography. His previous book, Sex and Punishment, covered 4,000 years of sex laws. Berkowitz is a lawyer and journalist who now represents lesbians and gays as well as domestic abuse victims seeking asylum in the U.S. Eric Berkowitz, welcome to Fresh Air. So before we get to 20th century and 21st century laws pertaining to sex, what do you consider to be among the very earliest laws regulating sexual behavior?
Well, there were so many. There are some that are just strange that have to do with sex with animals. You know, pigs are accepted, cows aren't, etc.
Really? Those, who was that?
Yeah, those were laws of the Hittites and the Babylonians. And in fact, most ancient societies had pretty clear lines as to what members of the animal kingdom were acceptable and not. But really, the first death penalty law that I could find had to do with adultery. That was the first capital crime, and it was enforced vigorously. Also, there were—
Can I just stop you? Was that enforced only against women, or was it enforced against men, too?
Women. Mm-hmm. In fact, we're going to find, as we go forward, many threads of law that were enforced only against women and not against men. Adultery in particular. Also, there were, we think, you know, this isn't exactly proven, but the earliest threads that we could find had to do with laws barring sex with women during their periods. That was considered a very volatile thing that might create atmospheric disturbances and you know, the wrath of God. Also, incest itself in some, not all societies was considered a bad thing.
So let me skip ahead several thousand years to the 20th century and the 21st century. You know, clearly the civil rights movement, the women's movement, the gay rights movement changed social standards and changed our understanding of sexuality and sexual equality. What are some of the things from earlier in the 20th century, so we're talking like, say, 100 years ago, some of the things that were legal or illegal then that would seem shocking to us now?
Oh, my gosh, Terry, there are so many. The first that I could think of is this whole notion of feeble-mindedness. There is this very, very strong urge by the law starting at the beginning of the century and really continuing to the present of looking to the social sciences to tell us what's right and what's wrong. You know, religion had been fading as a real moral force in the law for quite some time. It's still there, but it had been pulling back. And stepping into that role, science came in. And what were sins became mental illnesses. So I think of the idea that prostitutes at the beginning of the century were not only considered sinners, they were considered to be feeble-minded, congenitally promiscuous. Therefore, lots of prostitutes were sterilized. They were seen as a one-way flow of venereal disease toward men and then onward, upward the social scale to wealthy men. Therefore, we had to not only control them, but also cut them out of the gene pool. So there was this very, very strong sense that what were sometimes minor sins became major mental illnesses. Homosexuality, for one, went from being a sin, obviously, to something that was considered to be a congenital defect. In fact, homosexuals, even by their advocates, people who were advocating the reduction of penalties against homosexuals, saw them as troubled characters who were, well, they were called inverts, meaning that they were evolving in the wrong direction, evolving backwards. So when we began to view them as sick people, we also began to add symptoms to that sickness. So homosexuals starting in the 30s and 40s began to be seen as naturally inclined toward crimes against children, toward political disloyalty, toward all kinds of antisocial things. So what was a sin, having sex with someone of the same sex, became a very, very broad and dangerous thing. So those are two selections of many.
I'll just like throw in the miscegenation laws that made it illegal an African-American and a white person to marry. And it's really only very recently that those were finally taken off the books.
Absolutely. Miscegenation started with the idea that, well, one, it's to preserve white privilege, but also with the idea that blacks were naturally inferior, again, quack science, and that making children between blacks and whites, and also not just blacks, I mean, people of all kinds of races, would weaken the white gene pool. Eugenics was mainstream stuff. Everybody loved it in the early part of the century.
I think you can see a lot about how our understanding of gender equality and sexuality have changed by looking at how rape laws have changed. If you go back to the turn of the 20th century, what were rape laws like then, including spousal rape?
You know, if you're talking about spousal rape, we don't need to go back to the beginning of the 20th century. It was not until 1993 that all of the states had finally purged themselves of laws which held explicitly that it is impossible for a man to rape his wife. Now, that's 1993, reaching back thousands of years. That was simply the law for a long, long time.
What was that based on? What's the larger law that understanding that a man could forcibly take his wife and that's acceptable? What was that based on?
That was based on the very basic notion that when two people married, the wife lost her identity entirely. She became essentially merged into the being of her husband, sort of a metaphysical oddity called coverture. And so it was the idea that when a woman said, "I do," on the altar, she said, "You can," for the rest of her life. Saying "I do" was sort of a blanket consent, and it was also a blanket consent to male control, to the husband's control of the wife in 100 different contexts. So the question of whether a husband could rape his wife wasn't resolved until really the end of the 20th century. Rape and marriage simply didn't cross paths. Of course, husbands had been forcing sex on their wives throughout this period, and wives were simply left in the legal cold. It's a terrible thing. The development and change in rape law really, in a sense, mirrors the women's movement.
So you write that from 1927 on, the federal definition of rape was carnal knowledge of a female forcibly against her will. And it wasn't until 2012 that the FBI redefined rape so that it no longer required that the victim forcibly fight back against the rapist, which, I mean, so many women would be afraid to fight back. So many rapists say, if you fight back, I'm going to kill you. So that's a tough judgment call there. But anyways, what does that say to you that it was only in 2012 that the FBI changed the definition?
You know, when I was working on this book, there were so many things that astonished me, and this is one of them. I mean, 2012 is really yesterday, and the idea of physical force being a requirement, 2012 is at least 100 years too late. I mean, there's so many ways in which sex can be extracted from someone without force, and more than that, the insertion of the word force was often interpreted to put the woman in a position of not just resisting, but often resisting to the death. And so if a woman didn't come out of her situation with cuts, bruises, torn underwear, there was a presumption that she must have wanted it.
It wasn't until 2003 that the Supreme Court overturned any remaining anti-sodomy laws. And the sodomy laws were used primarily to in an attempt to make homosexual sex illegal. And what are some of the most interesting things that stand out in your mind about anti-gay laws from earlier in the 20th century?
There were many things. One, as I said earlier, you know, homosexuality was considered a mental illness. So when you call something an illness, you should beware the cures, you know. Homosexuals were put in mental hospitals. They were marked as sex offenders. They were lobotomized. They were chemically castrated. And so all that was in sort of kind of a quasi-medical legal effort. Essentially, what was going on is there was just simply the suppression of the homosexual population. Also, homosexuals were considered to be treasonous. And until recently, homosexuals were barred from being employed by the federal government, you know, the biggest employer, because they were believed to be politically disloyal. Homosexuals were excluded from society in a number of really, really critical ways, all in ways which were held to be sort of emblems of what the homosexual mental illness was.
Did the laws preventing gay people from holding federal positions, did those laws originate in the communist witch hunting era, or did they pre-exist that?
That's a great question. They absolutely came hand in hand with the Red Scare. There's something called the Lavender Scare as well, which actually has gotten short shrift in the popular imagination, along with the hunt for communists. In fact, it was said often, commies and queers, there was no less energetic a hunt to root out what were called perverts, and perverts of all kinds, from the federal government. In fact, about a week after McCarthy held up his fake list of communists in the State Department, it was revealed that there were also homosexuals in the State Department. This is back in around 1950. And so the purge, just the words used are just horrible against them, but the purge of homosexuals and sexual, quote-unquote, deviance of any kind continued in force 50s, 60s, and 70s.
In your writing about laws regulating homosexuality and homosexual behavior, you write that the American military had no official policy for keeping homosexuals out of its ranks until World War II. Gay sex in the armed forces had been a crime since the beginning of the Republic, but not being a homosexual. You could be a homosexual. Why did that change during World War II?
It was a fascinating process. It all, again, comes to the idea of homosexuality being less something one does to something one is. Okay, homosexuality until the 20th century was not necessarily a type of person. It was a dimension of sex. So starting in with World War II, a board of psychiatrists urged that the military start to exclude perverts and feeble-minded people from the armed forces. And, you know, top on that list were homosexuals, who were considered to be, again, politically disloyal, cowardly, etc. So as the entire country went to war, homosexuals were, at least in theory, barred from the effort.
And homosexuals were supposed to be weeded out at the draft board when they were...
Yeah, good luck with that.
When they were being inducted. What was the process like for determining who was a homosexual when the person didn't volunteer that information?
It was really a futile effort, because they're dealing with a population that had spent their lives learning how to quote-unquote pass. Okay, so we have military recruiters who are, you know, processing people at a very, very fast clip. And, you know, the truth is very few people resisted the war effort. So homosexuals were no less ready to fight than anyone else. So getting past a recruiter wasn't so hard. But recruiters were counseled to look for men who were effeminate in dress or manner, that's a quote, had feminine body characteristics, that's a quote also, and also who put down their occupational choices as interior decorators, dancers, or window dressers. I mean, it's an absolutely ludicrous, infantile thing, but that's the sheet that the recruiters had in front of them when they were going through the recruiting process.
So that's an example of a legal attitude that's changed a lot in the past few decades.
Hasn't been easy, but it finally did, yes.
Right. So during several decades of the 20th century, it was illegal to send birth control through the mail because of the Comstock Act. And I'd like you to describe the Comstock Act, which was passed in 1873, and how that ended up, how an anti-pornography law ended up affecting birth control.
Sure. Anthony Comstock is one of the more colorful and fun characters of the last 150 years. He was a dry goods salesman from Brooklyn, but his real métier was hunting sexual practices anywhere he could find them. And Comstock teamed up with the YMCA and got a federal law passed which barred pretty much the use of the mail for pretty much anything. Anything that smacked of sex, be it medical literature, birth control literature, playing cards, or pornography. So to expand on what you asked, it wasn't just sending birth control in the mail. Even sending a medical pamphlet about birth control in the mail was wrong. Anything, it was this notion that anything that was sexual was dangerous. And he didn't really trouble between the medical sexual, the counseling sexual, or the traditionally, you know, pornographically sexual. Sex itself was wrong. So birth control information was illegal. And someone like Margaret Sanger, who's the, you know, the giant of the birth control movement, was constantly running up against Comstock Act prosecutions. I mean, and so eventually birth control was sort of excised from the Comstock Act in the 30s. A court in New York said, well, we're not going to ban birth control if it prevents disease. We still want to ban birth control if it is there for sports sex. But if it's there to prevent disease, we're going to allow it. And that had to do with some diaphragms that this Japanese doctor sent in from Japan to New York. And so once that happened, the dike cracked and millions and millions and millions of condoms began to rain down from the sky. And birth control became much, much easier to acquire.
So when you look at the past 100 years and you look at what the sex laws are now, do you consider us legally to be in a relatively enlightened state?
I do. I mean, there's a lot to complain about, but all told, there is more protection for the individual body, particularly of the underprivileged, than in any other time I can recall.
Eric Berkowitz, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been an absolute pleasure, Terry.
Eric Berkowitz is the author of the new book, The Boundaries of Desire, about the past century of laws regulating sex. After we take a short break, Maureen Corrigan will review a new book by a writer whose home was built over a charnel house, a vault of bones. That sent her on a tour of bone houses through Europe. Also, we'll hear from Amanda Petrusich, who's written a book about 78s and the people who collect these recordings, and we'll listen to some rare 78s. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
This podcast and the following message are made possible by Vonage. In 2001, Vonage revolutionized home phone service, making it better. After such a colossal breakthrough, who would have objected if Vonage said, "Enjoy better, world, Vonage will be at the spa"? But today, Vonage is not at the spa, having its trouble area worked on, but transforming communications for your business with award-winning cloud-based solutions. See how your business can get the better it deserves. Call 1-800-5-VONAGE or go to Vonage.com. Vonage, the business of better.
Tourists in Europe usually seek out great cathedrals and museums or famous nature locales. Traveler Denise Inge, however, was seeking a different kind of vista. Here's Maureen Corrigan's review of Inge's book, A Tour of Bones.
Lots of us are afraid to confront the things lurking in our basements. In mine, it's the spider crickets. In Denise Inge's, it was the bones, piles of human bones that reached almost to the ceiling of the stone cellar beneath her house. When Inge's husband John was appointed the Bishop of Worcester Cathedral in 2008, she knew the house they'd be moving into with their two young daughters was built over an ossuary or charnel house. The bones of Benedictine monks were collected there in medieval times, and it was the job of the charnel house priest to pray for the souls of his fellow monks whose bones he lived above. As Inge quips in her profound and peculiar book, A Tour of Bones, the charnel house and its small chapel were a kind of left luggage room on a spiritual railway, bearing always an expectation of return or reunion. At the resurrection of the dead, it was believed these bones would live again. It took Inge a while to work up the courage to descend into that cellar, through a trap door no less, and outfitted only with a candle because, of course, all the flashlight batteries in her house had burned out. Gazing for the first time on all those skulls and femurs brought Inge face to face with the brevity of life and propelled her on a journey, both literal and spiritual, in which she visited bone houses throughout Europe. She says she wanted to stay with the uncomfortable sight of bare bones until I fear neither them nor the message of mortality that they utter. Like Thoreau, Inge also wanted to learn to live life more deliberately and, as she tells us, to look at myself without the flesh on. As a book, A Tour of Bones is as strange and chaotic, unsettling and inspiring as are any of the bone houses that Inge visited on her journey. There's the Skull Chapel in Chernia, a hamlet on the Czech-Polish border, where the ossuary contains some 24,000 bones dating back to the 30 Years' War and where the remains of sworn enemies lie jumbled together. In Zedlec in Czechoslovakia, the bones of some 40,000 people have been glued into giant chandeliers and chalices. Ropes of skulls hung as if they were festive garlands, cranial curves like fists of roses or clumps of chrysanthemums, a bizarre harvest from some garden of the dead. touring this display, which she doesn't know whether to regard as human remains or art, Inge keeps asking herself the question, what is this? Which triggers the deeper question, what am I? In Hallstatt, Austria, Inge is comforted by the ongoing custom of painting names and flowers on the skulls in the local bone house, which restores individuality to the remains. But it's while she's staring at the skulls there that she has the disturbing experience of glimpsing herself in a piece of metal. Between the real me and this fuzzy me, she says, stand ranks of skulls. They look at me and I look at them, and neither of us says a thing. We can't. They are beyond language, and I am without it. But I can see myself in the metal mirror, looking at my future and my present all at once. I glimpse what I look like now and what I will be reduced to one day. After she wrote most of this book, Inge was diagnosed with inoperable cancer. She died in 2014 at the age of 51. Appreciating the grim irony of her diagnosis, Inge says that, I started this book scared of the skeletons in my cellar. Before I had finished it, I looked scarcely more like a skeleton myself, emaciated by cancer and chemotherapy. To state the obvious, A Tour of Bones is not a beach book, but neither is it a free fall into despair. In her final chapter, Inge tells us that she's glad she began this pilgrimage before the cancer came, because the questions it raised about mortality and how to live more fully cannot be rushed and must not be avoided. It's somewhat trite, but nevertheless true to say that her vibrant voice, her presence on these pages, is in itself a kind of life beyond death.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University and is the author of So We Read On, How the Great Gatsby Came to Be and Why It Endures. She reviewed A Tour of Bones by Denise Inge. Coming up, we listen to some rare 78s and talk with Amanda Petrusich about her book, which is about 78s and the people who collect these recordings.
Support for this podcast comes from the new Starz original comedy Blunt Talk, starring Patrick Stewart as Walter Blunt, a British import intent on conquering the world of American cable news. That is, if network bosses, a dysfunctional news staff, and misguided decision-making don't derail his mission first. Don't miss the series premiere Saturday, August 22nd, only on Starz.
With almost all the music you'd ever want to listen to available online digitally for little or no money at all, depending on your scruples, the obsessive hunt for scratchy, fragile 78 records may seem anachronistic. But the collectors of 78s who ferret around dusty basements, attics, and junk sales have saved so much great music from oblivion, we have a lot to thank them for. Those collectors and the music they've found is the subject of the book Do Not Sell at Any Price, The Wild Obsessive Hunt for the World's Rarest 78 RPM Records, which has recently been published in paperback. Our guest is the author, Amanda Petrusich. She met with many prominent 78 collectors, went out on the hunt for records with them, and got bitten by the 78 collecting bug herself. Petrusich is a contributing writer for the music website Pitchfork and a contributing editor to Oxford American. She also teaches music criticism at NYU's Gallatin School. She spoke with and listened to some records with Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger. They started with one of the rarest 78s, Skip James' recording, Devil Got My Woman.
That's Devil Got My Woman by Skip James, recorded in 1931. It's one of the songs that Amanda Petrusich talks about in her book, Do Not Sell at Any Price. Amanda Petrusich, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what can you tell us about Skip James and this record?
Well, Devil Got My Woman is one of those records that I think people hear it and have an incredibly immediate and sort of dramatic reaction to it. There's a kind of great scene in the movie Ghost World, which features 78 collectors, which are also featured in my book, in which a character, a young woman played by Thora Birch, is talking to a collector about Devil Got My Woman, a guy played by Steve Buscemi. And she says, "I want to hear more records like that." And he looks at her and says, "There aren't any more records like that."
Right.
And for me, that's kind of a perfect encapsulation of the sort of strange and haunting beauty of that song.
When I was talking to people about your book, many of them didn't really know what 78 records were. So can you give us a little primer about the 78?
Sure. 78s are kind of the earliest iteration of what we think of as a record today. They were introduced around the turn of the century, and they are 10-inch flat grooved shellac discs that spun at around 78 revolutions per minute, hence the name. And they were double-sided. Each side contained about 2 to 3 minutes of music. And they're extraordinarily fragile. I mean, they were produced in finite quantities because home recording equipment was not nearly as common as it is today. So they weren't making as many, but they also have not survived in part because they're really easy to break. They're heavy and they're brittle. If you drop one on the floor at the wrong angle, it will just shatter into pieces like a dinner plate. It requires a particular kind of stylus, which is a little bit different from a contemporary stylus. It's thicker. And, of course, you need to find yourself a turntable that spins at 78 RPM in order to play them. And they were mostly phased out by the 1960s, but you can still find quite a few of them around at junk shops and antique malls.
Yeah, and also one thing I like about them, they're so organic. You write that they're made of wax and slate and cotton clay and shellac. And shellac itself is like a product, like a resin made from a bug, right?
Yeah, it's sort of cool to think about how organic they are. In part, that's contributed to their decay over mm-hmm. time, of course. But there is something about the material itself and the way that a particular 78 sort of wears its history on the face and in the grooves. Because they're malleable and they're fragile and they change depending on how they're played and how many times they've been played and whether there was a slope in the floorboard in the room where the phonograph was, where, you know, whether people were dancing while the record was spinning. There's something really nice about that material history getting kind of etched into the song itself, which, of course, is something that's very difficult to experience with a digital audio file.
One thing you say in the book is that, you know, living in the 21st century, it's kind of hard to imagine how songs from 25 years ago could become extinct so quickly. And you say in the 50s, when people started collecting 78s, the music, there it was so foreign it felt otherworldly to them.
Absolutely. And I think in part it's that a lot of the music that's been canonized, particularly the blues records that have been canonized by collectors, you know, they were made by outlier artists. So these weren't popular records even in their moment of release. And the fact that they were rediscovered and lionized later by figures, collectors, who I think in a way were the perfect audience for these records. I mean, we're talking about marginalized outlier performances becoming heralded by these marginalized outlier figures, however many years later. So it sort of makes sense to me in a way. But then there's also, of course, the fact that just not that many of these records were pressed, and they very quickly sort of receded into memory.
And I guess also they were marketed to African-American audience, while the people that later discovered them in the 50s were white guys, right?
Yeah. These records were almost all part of Race Records series, which were records recorded by African-American performers for African-American audiences. And that was something that started happening in the 20s. And I think it was a very mercenary impulse in a way on behalf of the record companies. It wasn't an idea that, oh, here's this kind of undiscovered art that, you know, people should hear. No one's hearing African-American singers. No one's hearing those songs. They should be commercially released. I don't think it was that at all. It was that suddenly it seemed like maybe there was a chance to make a little bit of money. And so many labels, including Paramount Records, which is based out of Grafton, Wisconsin, you know, launched these Race Records series that sort of, you know, and they cast a very wide net and I think accidentally ended up recording what are, to my ears, some of the greatest performances in American musical history. But they weren't curated. It was fortuitous and serendipitous, and I feel very grateful that it happened at all.
So the pursuit of 78s requires a certain obsessiveness, and at least one of the collectors that you talk about in your book, Do Not Sell at Any Price, describe his needs for records as almost like a disease. What were some of the lengths you saw collectors go to find important records?
It was interesting to me how frequently collectors would speak about their collecting as a kind of illness. I mean, it seemed like a compulsion. It was something they couldn't quite control, they didn't entirely understand, and that they couldn't necessarily reason with. I mean, you would hear stories of collectors, getting jobs like census worker or exterminator, jobs that would allow them to wander through rural southern neighborhoods and knock on people's doors without getting shot, sight unseen. They would have this guise of whatever the kind of professional trade was that they had happened to learn. Also, they could knock on doors and ask people if they had any records in their basements. You know, do you need to be sprayed for termites and do you have any records in your basement?
All right. Well, let's listen to another Paramount record. This one is a very rare one. I think this is Geechee Wiley, Last Kind Words Blues. How many versions of this exist?
I asked that question of a collector named Chris King recently, and he said 2.5, which, who knows what that means exactly. I believe there are two pretty decent copies of this record, including one that Chris owns, and then a third that is sort of in nearly unplayable condition. So 2.5.
And we don't really know much about Geechee Wiley, right?
Geechee Wiley is a bit of a cipher, and I think many collectors sort of enjoy her occupying that space. I mean, when you hear the song, it's so ghostly and so strange and so evocative that the idea that it's this woman about whom we know virtually nothing, it adds a little bit to it. I think it allows us to kind of project whatever we need into her voice and onto this performance. We do know that Geechee is likely a nickname. I think that probably her name was Lily May, and that Geechee referred to her being of Gullah descent or of the West African slaves that came through Savannah and Charleston. Other than that, we know very little. I mean, we don't know where she was born or where she died or what happened in between, other than that she recorded a handful of songs for Paramount in 1929.
Okay, well, let's hear this. This is Last Kind Words Blues by Geechee Wiley, recorded for Paramount Records in 1930.
The last kind words I hear my daddy say, Lord, the last kind words I hear my daddy say. If I die in the German war, I want to send my body, send it to my mother-in-law. Baggy chill, these all bear my soul. I can't just leave me out, let the buzzer see me go.
So that was Last Kind Words Blues by Geechee Wiley, recorded in 1930 for Paramount Records. It's one of the songs my guest Amanda Petrusich writes about in her book Do Not Sell at Any Price, The Wild Obsessive Hunt for the World's Rarest 78 RPM Records. It's just recently come out in paperback. Amanda, another thing I really like about these records is how little mediation there is between the musician and the listener. I mean, the singer, when recording these, the singer would sing into a microphone, and the microphone would create vibrations that would make a stylus cut these sound waves into this piece of wax. I mean, and that's the recording. There's no overdubbing. There's no editing. I mean, I think in the early recordings, there was hardly any mixing, right? I mean, it just feels so immediate.
Absolutely. No second takes. There was a red light that would come on in the studio often when a performer was sort of reaching the end of his or her, 3 minutes. So on a lot of these records, you can hear someone sort of start to hurry up and panic when the light came on that they had to finish up. But then the record just kind of went out into the world that way. And I think in addition to the way in which they were recorded, which, as you say, is unusual and kind of transfixing, there was also an unselfconsciousness, I think, to the way people used to sing that maybe we've lost a little bit of. I'm hesitant in general to kind of grant any credence to the way collectors are dismissive of contemporary music as being sort of soulless and dead. But I do think sometimes that they have a bit of a point there, that now performers are kind of hyper aware that they are making a thing that's going to endure. When they make a recording, they realize that it will have its own sort of material legacy, that it will be out in the world, that it can travel very quickly. And back then, I think, you know, they just weren't thinking about that. They just sang the song. You know, the repercussions were not necessarily at the front of their mind. I don't think any of these performers were thinking about the fact that this was going to be preserved. This was going to be their legacy. This was a kind of capital S statement. It was just, you know, a song that they sang one afternoon.
We're listening to the interview Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger recorded with Amanda Petrusich, author of Do Not Sell at Any Price. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Before we get back to Fresh Air, here's another podcast you might enjoy, the TED Radio Hour. You'll hear discussions about fascinating ideas, amazing inventions, fresh approaches to old problems, and new ways to think and create. You can find the TED Radio Hour podcast at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
So one of the collectors you met for the book and someone who's become a friend of yours is named Chris King. And you write that he's known for being really great at digitally remastering these 78s, and he's able to pull like extra sound out of these old records. How does he do that?
Watching Chris work feels to me a little bit like watching a magician pull a rabbit out of a hat. He will very carefully adjust the speed on his turntable, sometimes, you know, by as little of as like a tenth of a rotation. You know, something that you'd think, all right, we'll just put it on at 78 RPM. You know, he'll play it at 77.4 RPM. Or he will sometimes place a popsicle stick on the stylus if he feels that it's a record where the grooves have been gouged out and that the needle needs to get in there a little bit deeper. There's all these sort of little kind of funny analog tricks he does to make the thing sound as good as possible.
Well, King owns one of the 2.5 extant copies of Geechee Wiley, the record that we heard earlier. But he also owns a copy of what you describe as your favorite record of all time. It's called Sur le Bord de l'Eau by Blind Uncle Gaspard and was recorded in 1929. Why do you love this record so much?
I think this record contains a particular quality that I sometimes hear in pre-war American music that I have failed to find in almost any other genre or time period, which is this sort of unspeakable yearning. And of course, with this record, he's singing in French, and a French that's speckled with Creole idioms. So even if my French was better, I'm not sure I would understand what he's saying. So whatever it is that he's communicating, it's extra musical. It's something in the tone of his voice, the way that he plays the guitar. For me, it's just extraordinarily sad. When I try to imagine the circumstances that would lead someone to be able to sing this way, it is just devastating.
All right, well, let's listen to the song. It's Sur le Bord de l'Eau by Blind Uncle Gaspard. And we're going to start this about halfway in because at the end, there's this part where his voice kind of breaks up. And it's most likely like he just swallowed wrong or something and his voice caught. But, you know, the fact that he falters it really gives the performance a sort of extra emotional quality. So let's listen to this.
La belle chanson qui chante, j'aimerais la savoir. La belle chanson qui chante, j'aimerais la savoir. J'aimerais la savoir sur le bord de l'Nil. J'aimerais la savoir sur le bord de l'eau, sur le bord de mes eaux. Ma belle, rentrez dans ma page, je vous la montrerai. Ma belle, rentrez dans ma page. Je vous la montrerai sur le bord du Nil. Je vous la montrerai sur le bord de l'eau, sur le bord d'un vaisseau. La belle suite embarquée est se mi da pleurer, et se mi da pleurer de le bord du Nil, et se mi da pleurer de le bord de l'eau, de le bord d'un vaisseau.
Amanda, it's so great that this song exists in this version. You could imagine like a producer today saying like, okay, let's do another take, you know, try not to choke up at the end this time.
Yeah, absolutely, which seems so tragic. I feel like by the time he gets to the end of the song and you hear him sort of disintegrating a little, I mean, for me at least, that mirrors how I feel in that moment too. There's this sort of wonderful solidarity with him, which is like, yeah, man, it's life is hard. You know, I don't know. I would be so sad if that weren't possible. That kind of tiny moment of communion, which as you were saying earlier, is kind of made possible by these imperfections. Yeah. I think it's very human and very moving.
One of the reasons your book spoke to me is because, you know, I remember hunting down records, you know, not 78s, but 33s when I was younger, going to like the downtown, you know, secondhand shop and having a list of things I was looking for and finding one and being so excited and like clutching it on the subway home, you know, waiting to play it on my turntable. And there's such a thrill to that find. And, you know, I don't want to sound like the kind of grousing old guy, but that experience doesn't really exist for a lot of younger music listeners today.
It's true. That real joy of discovery and also of contextless discovery, I think, is something that younger listeners are not necessarily privy to, which does not, you know, mean that they don't have other things that we didn't have that are great and I'm envious of. But yeah, I mean, when I was a kid, I bought records all the time, kind of based on cover art, based on God knows what, and would bring it home and would have a real kind of moment of surprise. That was wonderful. I think it's rarer now for younger listeners to be surprised by what they hear. But yeah, absolutely. The relationship to music as an object, having something you can bring home and line up on your shelf and own and feel a real relationship with, feel a real sense of pride in, I think that's a really beautiful thing.
Well, Amanda Petrusich, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much. It was such a pleasure.
Amanda Petrusich spoke with Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger. Her book, Do Not Sell at Any Price, The Wild Obsessive Hunt for the World's Rarest 78 RPM Records, was recently published in paperback. Tomorrow, a wildlife story that's a crime story involving terrorist militias. We talk with journalist Brian Christie, who has investigated how terrorist militias are responsible for slaughtering African elephants, smuggling their tusks, and trading ivory for weapons, or selling the ivory for cash to fund their operations. He wrote the cover story for the September issue of National Geographic. I hope you'll join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross.